One person?
Okay, well.
And you've got your homework to do, I'm afraid, because there is quiz tomorrow.
I guess the problem.
The book's in the bookstore.
All right.
Problem with saying that is that all that's going to happen is that no one will show up tomorrow. And it's not like I have any hold over you whatsoever.
Well, if you're going to give out refunds, we will.
Refunds?
Yeah.
Well, that's possible. I will talk to the registrar and see what can be worked out.
If you're bored today.
And for the sake of the media people, I'm Doug Thorpe. I'm a professor of literature and writing at Seattle University, obviously in Seattle. Seattle Pacific is a free Methodist institution, very evangelical. And so I love teaching this novel in the context of an evangelical institution, because it's one of those books that can crack open broad perspectives. Leslie Silko is a Native American novelist from the Mexico area, Laguna Pueblo, to be specific. She is a mixed blood child, and that forms an important part of the novel. This whole notion of pure and impure plays into it, and it's interesting coming right off of Michael's reading of Romans 7, where issues of law and who's in, who's out, and purity and impurity, of course, are hugely important. And so Silko was playing with some of those same tensions.
One parent, a European American, and
yes,
the other Native American.
Exactly. Yeah. And in the area that Silko is from.
Same as Louise Erdrich. She has the same
background. Yeah, it's not unusual, of course.
German American and Native.
That's right. And in the Southwest, as probably all of you know, there are really three different primary cultures that are intermixing. You have what was a Spanish culture that came in 15th, 16th century. So a Spanish speaking culture. You have the Native American culture, and then you have the Anglo-European culture all coming together.
Yes.
And one of the things...
Northern European.
Northern European as opposed to Spanish. Okay. One of the things the novel will be dealing with is the tensions around those, around the questions of diversity and both strengths and possible tensions around the mixing of those cultures. And these are, of course, subjects that are ripe for discussion today as well. So, Leslie Silko's Ceremony. As you open this novel, you've got a title page. It's a novel. You've got a Native American writer, and right there, there's already some tension because we think of the Native American culture not as a written culture primarily, but an oral culture. Leslie Silko herself knows very little of Karasen, the Laguna Pueblo language, so she is already somewhat removed from that oral culture. She has an aunt and a grandmother, as a great aunt and a grandmother, who did share stories from the family and from the larger culture. But her Aunt Susie, who was a very important person in Leslie Silko's life, also was a school teacher, had a college degree, and was a writer herself. She wrote down stories. So Leslie Silko is the inheritor of these different traditions. And it was very clear to her early on that her own path was going to be writing rather than oral storytelling. So she is already inhabiting, and she's writing in English, in a sense, the enemy's language, if you want to put it that way. And there is a famous book edited by wonderful poet Joy Harjo about speaking in the enemy's language. And if you stop for a minute and think about this, I mean, we're so accustomed to being the dominant language that it's very difficult for us to imagine what it would be like to lose our language. But attempt to imagine that at the age of 6, you are sent from New Mexico as Silko's great aunt, Aunt Susie, and grandmother was. You are sent from New Mexico from your family culture, your family language, family stories. And you're sent to Carlisle, Pennsylvania, Carlisle Indian School. where it is, I mean, you are literally beaten, whipped, if you are caught speaking your native language. And so the whole idea at Carlisle, and this was a very enlightened notion. I mean, these were the liberals. These are the liberals who basically thought what you do is you essentially eradicate the Indian from the person and make them civilized, make them Northern European. Okay? And so you have Aunt Susie, who already herself is a blend or a living in tension with these two different cultures. She is sent to Carlisle, she learns English, she learns to write, she learns to read. And on the one hand, these are incredibly powerful tools. And on the other hand, they were tools that were used as weapons in order to eliminate something else. And so Leslie Silcone's ceremony is using writing as a means to try to revivify, in some ways, her own culture, the culture of oral storytelling. And yet she's doing it in writing. As you walk into the novel, title is Ceremony. And the first pages before you get to the pages that I gave you on the handout begin like this. Yes. I have one more. And if those who are completely bereft can share, that would be very helpful. Okay, so that's great. So anybody else completely? Okay. And this is not on the handout, but this is how the novel, in a sense, starts. And this is centered on the page. So as you start to read it, you're confused. Now, where am I? It starts like this. Tsitsinako, thought woman, capitalized, thought woman, is sitting in her room, and whatever she thinks about appears. She thought of her sisters, Natsitiyi and Iksitiyi, and together they created the universe, this world, and the four worlds below. Thought woman, the spider, named things, and as she named them, they appeared. She is sitting in her room, thinking of a story now. I am telling you the story she is thinking. So that's the threshold, in a certain way, that we walk through into this novel. And obviously, it is a creation story. It takes us back to the origins of things. And those of us sitting in this room can easily translate this. I mean, this is Jehovah creating the universe, creating Adam, and Adam naming the animals. Thought woman, the spider. And so the spider, this small creature, is identified, personified is what we would say, personified meaning, well, that's not really true, but we recognize it as a figure of speech, that this spider is identified with this creative source. And why a spider? Yeah,
because it's saying that what that was, they fabricate,
and those webs are threads that are interconnected, and so on. Yeah, and so that image of the spider web runs through the novel. It's also, spider webs are not exactly linear. It's not like you have just one line that goes across. Spider web is this interwoven fabrication, and it works because of its interconnectedness. And so it's through this voice, of course we've got a narrative voice, that is then telling us, but telling us that it is really thought woman who is telling the story, right? Who is behind the story. And another way of putting it is we're in a mythic universe. If you remember the beginning, I'm sure you do. You remember the beginning of the Odyssey? Homer's Odyssey. Right? Sing in me, muse, and through me tell the story of the wanderer, etc., etc. Sing in me and through me tell the story. Not that much different, really. In other words, Homer frames the entire tale as coming from this powerful source, a God, right? The spirit, if you want to put it that way. And the story then takes place within that spiritual or sacred framework. So too with ceremony. So we walk into this novel, and we are very quickly in a really large space. And yes, I think a sacred space. The space that this thought woman, in a sense, has woven, that is the entire cosmos, the entire world, and thus, ultimately, this story as well, which is going to be the story of a young man named Teo, primary character Teo, who, along with his half-brother Rocky, fought in World War II, enlisted, fought in World War II in the in Asia, and Rocky dies. Teo comes back filled with guilt, filled with what we would call post-traumatic stress disorder. He is sent to a VA hospital. He's home, he's sent to a VA hospital. He has what we would call a mental breakdown. We'll see this in the early pages of the novel. So he has what we would call a mental breakdown. He's sent to a VA hospital. The doctors there can't really do much for him. He doesn't speak. He is silent. And he can't eat or won't eat, or whatever he eats, he regurgitates or vomits up. And even that, in a way, becomes a metaphor. There is something that Teo cannot stomach, simple language. There's something that he's seen, that he's witnessed, that he cannot tolerate. He cannot, literally, he cannot stomach it. In a real basic way, Teo, of course, is sick. He is ill. He is out of health. Or, if we're going to pick up from Paul in Romans, we could say that he is living in the midst of sin, has experienced sin, and is in desperate need of healing. In a Christian context, we might say, Teo needs salvation. He needs salvation. Salvation, rooted Latin root, salve, healing. And so Teo needs healing. Salvation has to do with some basic kind of healing. And this is what Teo needs.
Wholeness.
Wholeness, exactly.
Yeah. Making
exactly.
Whole.
A sense of wholeness. This is what Teo needs. And there's a way in which about all works of literature move from the state of fragmentation, brokenness, woundedness, sinfulness. And then the question is, how do we move from this state to a state of wholeness or harmony or completion and so on? I mean, essentially, this is what literature does. And sometimes that process requires a death. Think about great Shakespearean tragedy. Hamlet. There is a cancer in the land. This is language that Shakespeare uses all the time because of his experience of England. And how do we bring about healing? Well, there has to be some kind of bringing forth of that trauma, of that injustice. And sometimes that requires a death. And we can think of that as a sacrificial death. But ultimately, even in those tragedies, you wind up with a community that is in the process of restoration. There is some sense. And of course, in comedy, we all know how healing and restoration takes place. Marriage. Oh, people are laughing. Jane Austen, classic example. Again, Shakespearean comedies. And Shakespeare is often four or five marriages. It's like, that's the way it works. So it is in ceremony. We walk into the novel, and that's the experience. But to me, one of the interesting things is that before we actually get to the actual plot, we have this introductory material. So it's as if, and if I had more space here, I would show you. It's as if the plot Teo's story is already framed within a larger story, a mythic story. And so our story, and Teo in a certain sense is us, is already held within a frame that suggests that there is an underlying order and pattern to things. In fact, once we pass through these opening pages, right before, and this is where I think your handout starts, right before the novel itself starts on page 4, you'll see one word. And that word is what?
Sunrise.
And it's isolated there on the page. It's a little bit like that, you know, a linguistic version of that sun up there somewhere.
Any more possible sharings for these folks?
Yeah.
All
right. Thank you.
Oh, it's random word.
So you see, that single word sunrise, and then you turn the page, and finally you get to, again, mostly a blank page, and at the bottom of the page, page 5, Teo didn't sleep well that night. He tossed in the old iron bed, and the coiled springs kept squeaking even after he lay still again, calling out humid dreams, a black night, loud voices rolling him over and over again like debris caught in the flood. At that point, if you're my students, you perhaps relax a little bit, because this feels like a novel. Call me Ishmael. It was the best of times, it was the worst. I mean, it's like we're in prose, we're in a narrative, we're starting to get a story at last. And we relax a little bit because we're trained to think of, you buy a book that's called a novel, and this is what you're expecting. And so it'd be easy, in a way, to kind of skip over that earlier stuff because it doesn't really make much sense, and go right here. But in fact, again, the important stuff in some ways is that frame. So why the word sunrise?
Beginning?
Sure, absolutely. Okay. So it alludes to something beginning, something starting. Yeah.
Teo's waking up.
Teo is also waking up. Okay. Yeah. It certainly is juxtaposed between the kind of waking up we see with Teo and the way we perhaps associate sunrise. If you have the novel in your hand, which you don't, I do. It's a little cheating, a little bit. And I will turn to the very end of the novel, and the last words of the novel are, "Sunrise, accept this offering, sunrise." And Thursday, at least that's the intended day for arrival at that ending. But going and looking at that, you suddenly realize, oh, okay, we essentially begin and end in the same way, in the same place. It's just that by the end, you don't only have that word sunrise isolated, but you have sunrise. Accept this offering, sunrise. So what do you have at the end? What would you call that?
Another beginning?
It's certainly another beginning.
A prayer.
A prayer. Yeah, it is a prayer. It is an invocation, a calling in of something. So we have gone in a cycle, and we're all very familiar with this, one day following another, one season following another. But there's also some sense of having moved from one place to another. This is the paradox we live in, I think, as human creatures. And again, you can translate this in terms of Christian liturgy and church calendar, which goes around and around and around exactly the same way. Again, teaching in an evangelical place, it's like I'm always shocked to feel like I'm doing missionary work there. Oh, thank you so much. Anybody, there are a couple more copies here. That's that back there. Anybody else? Okay. So I'm always amazed when I say to students, well, what is Advent? What is Advent? They don't know. They don't know. The beginning of the church year, Adventare, to come to us. Advent is followed by what season?
Christmas.
Christmas, right. And Christmas falls, shockingly, right at the winter solstice in the northern hemisphere. I mean, there's something very beautiful about how the church calendar, in fact, works with nature's calendars, with an underlying natural process. And so you have Easter in the spring.
There's a rhythm.
There is. There is this rhythm to it. And so what the church calendar suggests, and I think the model is doing something similar, is that even as we are passing through our daily life, that seems, you know, on the one hand, to be very linear. There's birth, there's death, and sometimes without much meaning. There, that same daily linear process is held in a deeper framework, which says that all of these times are really held within a ceremonial context, context of the body of Christ or the Logos. All of this is hell. And so it's a paradox in a way, because Easter comes once a year, and yet on a daily basis people are celebrating the risen Christ. It's not that that just happens on Easter.
Well, there's a tradition of every Sunday being a little Easter,
exactly.
A repeat of Easter.
Yeah, and clearly each week has that same kind of feel to it. And if you are living a liturgical life or living deeply into that calendar, there's a way in which every day you know that your day is really held and framed. Psalm 51 morning prayer in the Book of Common Prayer. Open my lips, O Lord, and my mouth shall proclaim your praise. Create in me a clean heart, renew within me a clean spirit, sustain me with your body. So on and so forth. And if you are in the habit of using morning prayer, noon prayer, there is a kind of reminder that, yes, my life really is held within something that transcends time, actually. I mean, that's the experience of Eucharist. There is this simultaneously a sense of time, present, something very human, and yet something that seems to transcend that. This eternal sense that you can't prove, but is something we all know, I think. We all know this. I remember when I was in college, and before I would have called myself a Christian, I was raised Presbyterian. I spent a winter in Ripon, Yorkshire, in England. And it was one of the cathedral cities, although the smallest of the cathedral cities. And I would go down to the cathedral. And I was able to do this because no one knew me. I would have been far too embarrassed if I had been back at college and people knew who I was. I mean, the idea of going to church, and especially at the time of the Eucharist, the Lord's Supper, walking up the aisle and then kneeling, putting my hands out and receiving, this is the body of Christ. Receiving this, it would have been almost unimaginable. And yet, I vividly remember that experience. That it felt like suddenly I was known, I was held, and this moment seemed to transcend. I was really held. Another word for it would be, I felt oriented. I felt like I had arrived home somehow. I was centered. All those words. The word orient means what?
Positioning
yourself in a certain way.
Facing the east.
Sure, we still use that, you know, the orient is to the east. And of course, it is orienting towards the sun, orienting towards the light. And so orientation, that literal sense of orientation, also has a figurative, a metaphorical or psychological, and certainly spiritual quality. How are you, which way are you oriented? To what are you oriented? And you're oriented, again, it's all moving us into this novel, but in Silko's world, you're oriented in part by knowing your place. And there's a literal quality to that in Silko. You know your place. You know there is a sacred mountain here, a sacred mountain here. You really know where you are. And you know that these are not just geographical locations, but these are part of a mythic story. They have meaning. They have life. They have a sacredness to them. So that is the orientation. That's always a good question. According to what am I oriented? This is, gets us close to Paul and Romans. What is my orientation? Now, what does all this have to do with ceremony, both as a novel and as an idea? What's the function of ceremony? Ceremonies do. We had one last night. Did you go here?
Helps us remember.
Okay.
Yeah. Over and over again.
Yeah. So, yes, it helps us to remember. I'm going to stick this word in here because it's important. And, yes, to remember. It's almost as if you've lost a limb. Right? There is a member that needs to be reconnected. I mean, again, there's something very physical at the heart of that word. So absolutely, there is a sense of remembering. And the remembering is a reconnecting to something larger, which we would call the body of Christ, which we can either decide is a metaphor, meaning that it's not real, or we try to take Paul seriously. And maybe occasionally we have that real sense. And this too, to me, really speaks to what Silko was getting at from a very different framework, really, than a Christian one. But I often push my students on this one, too. You know, what, do we really mean it? That we're members of the body of Christ? Do we really experience that? I mean, what I mostly experience is that I'm here, you're there, I'm doing most of the talking, and you're... Some of you I know, some of you I don't know. And it's not that I have animosity, but I also don't necessarily experience you as part of my body fully. And one of the beautiful things about Holden, this is my advertisement, I think Holden is one of those places where perhaps a little more easily we do get that sense. Sitting at the Ark, and it's after dinner, and there's kids playing, and there's all different kinds of folks. And you don't know most of them, but you watch this, and it's like a dance. There's a sense of real beauty. And it's not that it's choreographed. It's not that anybody is controlling anything. It's just part of the extraordinary. And yet, there is a sense of it all being held. What is it held by? It's mysterious. It's held by this geographical location. Does anybody doubt the importance of this geographical location for Holden as a community? It just feels crucial. But it's also clearly not just a geographical location. It's not that we think of, that we're not worshiping the mountains. And yet the mountains are very much part of the spirituality of this place. And it's also not that it's a fixed community. Part of the amazing thing about Holden is that it's constantly in flux. It's constantly changing. So it's not that it's set. There are those who are in, those who are out. Anybody can show up here, quite literally. And they are part of the community. Period. That's it. And at moments, I think we experience that as a living reality, as opposed to just an idea. And so there is something that holds us as one. And One way we experience that or re-experience that is exactly in ceremony. My daughter got married 4.5 weeks ago, speaking of ceremonies. And I will try not to take the rest of the time. I have my laptop here. I just happen to have 3,000 pictures. Oh, isn't she beautiful? Oh, isn't her? Yeah, that's scary.
I'd like to see that.
We can share those later. But as a ceremony, again, it's clearly not just about the two people. You know, the community comes together. It's at the church where our daughter grew up in Seattle, St. Mark's Cathedral, Episcopal Cathedral. There were two priests there, a male and female, who celebrated together. Both of them had been mentors to my daughter. So there was deep meaning in that, and there was meaning in that for many of the parishioners who watched her grow up. And then families come from all over the country, and farther even. And so you look at this, and you think, this is quite miraculous. If you're lucky, if you're not so lucky, you think, this is chaos. This is both. I'm related
to this person now.
But it's, you know, even when it's not, you know, I go to a number of weddings for my students, and it's always the same feeling. This amazing thing that biologically, the one thing we know is you cannot marry a member of your family, a close member of your family. Biologically, genetically, you have to go outside the tribe. It's a really beautiful job. If you don't do that, genetically we know it's going to lead to a disaster. And it's peculiar in a way, because you would think, no, we want to stay within the family. That's purity. That's an ultimate form of purity. I want to stay within the family. Right? These are the ones I know, I can trust, et cetera, et cetera. That's the one thing you can't do. And that, too, I think, speaks to what Silpo's trying to get in terms of Teo as himself a mixed blood who seems to be impure, who is an outcast in certain ways, never quite fits in any community. And yet Teo is the hero of the story. So Teo, who bridges cultures, that's central to what Silpo was trying to get at. So ceremony. In a way, in walking into the novel, we walk into ceremony. Sunrise. It's the beginning of a ceremony. The beginning of the novel proper. And if somebody, you know, we read the first couple of lines, but if somebody would just continue and read through that first long paragraph. We'll just go back to the beginning. If Teo didn't sleep well that night.
Teo didn't sleep well that night. He tossed in the old iron bed, and the coiled springs kept squeaking, even after he lay still again, calling up humid dreams of black nights and loud voices rolling him over and over again like debris caught in a flood. Tonight, the singing had come first, squeaking out of the iron bed, a man singing in Spanish, the melody of a familiar love song, two words, again and again. Y volveré. Sometimes the Japanese voices came first, angry and loud, pushing the song far away, and then he could hear the shift in his dreaming like a slight afternoon wind changing its direction, coming less and less from the south, moving into the west, and the voices would become Laguna voices. And he could hear Uncle Josiah calling to him, Josiah bringing him the fever medicine when he had been sick a long time ago. But before Josiah could come, the fever voices would drift and whirl and emerge again, Japanese soldiers shouting orders to him, suffocating damp voices that drifted out of the jungle, drifted out in the jungle steam, and he heard the women's voices then. They faded in and out until he was frantic because he thought the Laguna words were his mother's, But when he was about to make out the meaning of the words, the voice suddenly broke into a language he could not understand. And it was then that all the voices were drowned by the music. Loud, loud music from the big jukebox, its flashing red and blue lights, pulling the darkness closer.
You're hired. So, if you're my students, you look forward to arriving finally at what looks like a plot, a story, that you can sink your teeth into. But then you get into it, and what have you got? How clear is this open paragraph in terms of what's going on?
Yeah.
I mean, that's probably what we would conclude. And you have a bit of an advantage because I gave you a tiny piece of framework to the novel about who this character is and some of his background. But nonetheless, it is confusing. So there is this tension between, on the one hand, this framework of Tsunako, Thought Woman, the spider who creates all things. And there's a sense of order and coherence to it. And the word sunrise, walking in through sunrise, through a beginning, through that place of orientation. That's the big framework. And then we get into the plot itself, and in a sense, all hell is broken out. We're in a state of chaos, a state of complete disorder. Things are all tangled up. This is what I put on the board as the kind of framework. In Christ, all things hold together. Line from one of Paul's epistles. In Christ, all things hold together. The word coherent literally means to hold together, to cohere. Like adhesive is that same root, attachment. All things hold together. Coherence comes in Christ. And coherence has two meanings. To be coherent means I understand. I'm coherent, hopefully. But literally, it does mean that what someone is saying hangs together in a certain way so that it makes sense. So your goal is to be coherent, do things in a proper order so it's understandable.
To be credible. Huh? Yeah. To be credible.
To be credible.
Believable.
That's what you need. And then a quote from a wonderful rabbinic scholar, Aidan Steinsaltz, a book called 13 Petal Rose. He is a scholar of Jewish Kabbalah, among other things. As the sages have said, before creation, God looked into the Torah and made the world accordingly, by which it is implied that the Torah is the original pattern of the world. And this will be an interesting phrase, those of you who are going to be attending the Bible study too, in the connection with Paul, and an understanding of law, or Torah, which is the books of the Bible, but is the law as well. And look what Steinsaltz does with this, the Torah. God looked into the Torah and made the world accordingly. So the Torah as law is not just the law the way we tend to think of it. It is that organizing principle or that underlying reality through which all things are made, rather like the way we understand love goes. So Torah is that underlying originated pattern of things. And then the Navajo word, Hojo, which is usually translated as beauty. In beauty we walk. There's a famous medicine chant in Navajo that ends with this repeated phrase, in beauty we walk. But Gary Witherspoon, who has done an extensive study of Navajo language, says, well, Hojo really means the positive or ideal environment. It is beauty, harmony, good, happiness. It refers to an environment in which is all-inclusive. Hojo is health. This comes back to this notion of salvation or wholeness. Hojo is health, which involves a proper relationship to everything in one's environment. That was the way health was understood within a Navajo framework. So there's this underlying pattern, this underlying harmony, this underlying orientation where everything in a certain sense has its place. and you know your place within that larger framework. And the novel establishes that as existing, and then sets us loose within a particular piece that is in a state of complete disorder. In an odd way, it's a huge leap. In an odd way, it's not unlike the Divine Comedy by Dante. Now, what do I mean by that? Opening lines of the Divine Comedy. Midway through the journey of our life, I found myself, in the journey of our life, I found myself lost in the dark woods. That is, the Divine Comedy begins exactly the way this novel begins, a recognition of being utterly lost and not being able to find, not being able to orient oneself. Dante's Divine Comedy is written in an incredibly precise rhyme scheme, metrical scheme. And so as you start reading the Divine Comedy, it's a rhyme scheme done in three, right? There are three patterned rhymes that run all the way through this massive text. Why three? In Christian context,
Trinitarian.
Always go to the, that pattern represents a Trinitarian model. And so Dante's rhyme scheme is a constant reminder that we are held within a pattern that makes sense, that coheres, that is harmonious, that is beautiful. We experience that in Dante's Italian as we start to read it, even as we're moving deeper and deeper into hell. It's really this extraordinary paradox. We have this taste. In a certain sense, God, for Dante, of course, exists in hell in a certain way. It's that all the people in hell are entirely disoriented. They are turned the wrong way. That is, they are turned towards themselves. This, again, is very Pauline. And so Teo, as we start this novel, well, Teo, the sentences make sense, right? It's English. English syntax, there's nothing particularly peculiar about that. Teo didn't sleep well that night. Oh, okay, I get that. I know where I am. There's a guy. Teo, don't recognize his name, really. Okay. Didn't sleep well that night. Oh, sorry to hear it. He tossed in the old iron bed. The coiled springs kept squeaking even after he lay still, calling up human dreams of black night and loud voices, rolling him over and over again like debris caught in a flood. Now, by that time, we're in a long sentence, and if you haven't had grammar in a long time, you might like, there's a subject and a verb. He tossed in the old iron bed. That part makes sense. But by the end of that sentence, you're feeling a little bit more disoriented, partly because of the length of it and because of all the different analogies. Okay, coiled springs kept squeaking. Well, that makes sense. The coiled springs then are calling up human dreams of black nights and loud voices, and the loud voices are rolling him over and over again, like debris caught in a flood. If you trace it back grammatically, you can see how it is all connected, actually. It all is connected. Although taken together, it feels incredibly disorienting. The coiled springs. Well, the coiled springs. Coiled springs? Now we're in the lit class, I guess, aren't we?
Old bed.
For sure. Yeah. What does it evoke, that feeling, coiled springs?
Like he's ready to snap.
Tension. Yeah, isn't that right? I mean, so Silco gets that quality with that adjective, these coiled springs, which simply refer to the bed and give us some information about that. But you can feel that tightness. And that is Teo's condition, exactly. Those springs and the squeakiness of it, the disturbance, in turn, impact him, call up dreams, black night, loud voices. Again, all this is connected. And those voices are rolling him
over and over again, like debris caught in a flood.
Okay.
Like debris caught in a flood. So he is debris, he is trash. He's caught in this water. And water is also, of course, life-giving, et cetera. But in this context, the water is destroying. And he is just trash. So by the end of the second sentence, oddly enough, we're oriented to his disorientation. I mean, that's where we live. And it goes on from there. Well, tonight the singing had come first, squeaking out of the iron, but a man singing in Spanish. We don't have any clue about why this is. Two from the two words, evolvere, and evolvere would mean, and I will return, and I will return, which is interesting. Again, given the framework, sunrise, sense of some kind of pattern, and I will return. But there's no context for us here. She just throws us into this. Later on in the novel, we will know the source of those words. Tomorrow, we will meet a character named the Night Swan that Teo goes to see and has a sexual relationship with, which is profoundly healing, actually, for him, which we'll have to explore a little bit. But those words are associated with the Night Swan. We don't know that. So the novel intentionally is disorienting us as well. We are experiencing something of what Teo experiences. And if you're here for Michael's Bible study again, he was very humorous the way he put it. You know, he sort of left everybody with, well, go out and have a miserable day, we're all miserable wretches, and so on and so forth. And yet there's this underlying piece to this. There's this underlying truth to this. That all of us, and some of us it's much closer today than it is for others, but all of us know that experience, this disorientation, the sense of, you know, I thought I knew where I was. I thought I knew where I was going. And then something happens. There's a death in the family, or you fail at something, or you break something. You break a relationship. I mean, we all know that experience. And then there is this, what feels like this truth about us revealed. And that's Dante again. I am lost. Of course, the good thing is to actually know that. I mean, the only reason the Divine Comedy can stop is because Dante figured out. He looked up and saw, whoa, I do not know where I am. And that's the beginning of the journey. I always welcome that moment in students who finally show up at my office and say, I'm lost. I thought I knew who Jesus was. I thought I knew who God was. I thought I knew what my faith was. But it doesn't match anymore. It's huge. It's huge. And actually very beautiful. It's this cracking open. And so that's Teo. He's just in it. So evolvere, there's all these languages, the Luna voice, the Spanish voice, Japanese voices. What are these Japanese voices doing here? Yeah,
out of his military experience, apparently.
Yeah, right. Yeah, absolutely. And we might, even without knowing anything, if we know some history and so on, we might jump there. We might think, oh, I wonder. But we really are not clued in. We are left with these fragments, it's another way of putting it. We're left with fragments that we can't quite put together. All these different voices. And so Teo is himself tangled up in all of this, and he can't sort things out for himself. So he lies in the morning. This is the next paragraph. He's not been able to sleep for a long time. At the bottom of the page, he could get no rest as long as the memories were tangled with the present. Tangled up like colored threads from old grandma's wicker sewing basket when he was a child. And he had carried them outside to play, and they had spilled out of his arms into the summer weeds and rolled away in all directions. And then he had hurried to pick them up before Auntie found him. He could feel it inside his skull, the
tension of little threads being pulled, and how it was with tangled things, things tied together, and as he tried to pull them apart and rewind them into their places, they snagged and tangled even more. So Teo had to sweat through those nights when thoughts became entangled. He had to sweat to think of something that wasn't unraveled or tied in knots to the past, something that existed by itself, standing alone like a deer. That's Teo's state of mind. I love the novel. I think Silva does an extraordinary job placing us inside the framework of this absolute terror. I mean, this is a mental breakdown. Sheer panic of just, I can't put anything together. And everything is overwhelming. It's all way too complex. The simplest things feel too complex and confusing. And it's embarrassing, and you know it shouldn't be like this, but that's Teo. Sure, and it, we'll find out, it does go back to his experience in Japan and his experience with life. But for now, again, he can't make any sense out of it. And it's not surprising that Silke would use this metaphor of threads, this grandmother's sewing basket, and even a little bit of sense of fear. Dumps over these threads, they get tangled up, and somehow he's then trying to put things back together the way they're supposed to be, and only makes it worse, and he's panicked. And this also gives us a sense of Teo growing up, that the environment did not feel very safe for him. Ideally, if you're a child and this happens, you're not in a state of panic, go to mom or grandmother, and it's like, don't worry, let's sit down, we'll untangle it, and it's like you suddenly recognize, oh yeah, this you can fix things, and it's not so bad. But if you didn't have that experience, then breaking things, tangling things up, is cause for severe stress. So what Teo wants to do is to separate things out, so they'll make more sense. Something like a deer standing alone. And then this image. If he could hold that image of the deer in his mind long enough, his stomach might shiver less and let him sleep for a while. It worked as long as the deer was alone. As long as he could keep it a gray buck on an unrecognized hill. But if he did not hold it tight, it would spin away from him and become the deer he and Rocky had hunted. Memory. It goes into memory. Almost inevitably. That memory would unwind, and there's that image, unwind into the last day when they had sat together, oiling their rifles in the jungle of some nameless Pacific island. While they used up the last of the oil in Rocky's pack, they talked about the deer that Rocky had hunted, and the corporal next to them shook his head and kept saying he had dreamed the Japs would get them that day. So these are the different contexts the tale is living. So as long as he can isolate the deer, so it's a generic deer on a generic hillside, he can keep things separate and isolated, and he is not so overwhelmed. But how successfully can we do that? And does salvation lie in this way of trying to bring healing? As long as I keep things separate in their own compartments, and this is obviously a neurosis that probably all of us have to one degree or another. So the books have to go here, and they're all in alphabetical order. It's like, wow, my world is whole, it feels safe. That's what Teo's trying to do. That isolated quality, which stands against, in opposition to, the way things actually work. Nothing works in isolation. Just like Silko's sentences. Nothing is ultimately isolated. And the attempt to isolate things is death-dealing. And you go back to the talk about Romans today, and Michael was talking a little bit about this notion of separation, separating things, the way the law separates, creates very clear boundaries. And that sense of separation. Silco, raised in a Western culture, went to college in New Mexico, that is, learned how to think analytically, which is one of the things college does. I mean, much of Western learning is based on a kind of analysis, whether it's in biology, literally dissecting, separating things out so that you can understand them, or whether it's an English class, you know, grammar, or just analysis literally means to separate things out, to take them apart. And it is a powerful way of learning. But the fact that you have to kill things in order to do that indicates a potential problem with it. That it is a way of learning, but it stands in opposition to an underlying sense that, in fact, those things that we isolate, you can't really understand them in isolation. Can you understand a frog and its frogness simply by dissecting the frog? No. And you can learn a lot about frog and frogness. I like that. Frogness. That's the frog. But no, you've got to go where frogs live and learn to speak frog. Yeah.
But you can learn about the relationship with the parts. The relationship with the parts that make that frog.
Yeah.
Then you can learn how it relates to the outside of life.
Yeah. And the relationship with the parts. I mean, the frog is its own entity, but part of the frog's parts are the environment that it lives in. That's part of what's a frog.
Diagramming a sentence. You pull out the parts of speech.
Sure, yeah.
But they have to interconnect to make sense.
Yes.
To make a statement.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah. So a word, you know, a single word has meaning, but really doesn't have much meaning until it is connected in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so that's Teo's problem. He wants to try to isolate things as a means of solving his dilemma, which is what we often do. Think about Descartes. He really wandered all over the map today. This is just the basic liberal arts education. So Descartes's famous words, cogito ergo sum, I think therefore I am. Where did Descartes go to do this? He isolated himself in a room in Amsterdam as a way of trying to arrive at what is fundamental, what he can put him, you know, what's the groundwork that he can stand on. How does he do it? He isolates himself, cuts himself off completely from everything. And what he arrives at is, well, I think, therefore I am. And it's just that pure isolation of that consciousness, that individual consciousness. And that is the kind of knowing. But it's a very different kind of knowing that the novel is going to try to suggest it's healthy. And so, okay, Teo, Descartes, both out there in that isolated room. So, and he's there in his bed, humid air, turned into sweat. Bottom of page 7 we're on now. He sees the skin of the corpses. The Tsarist has told him to kill all the Japanese soldiers lined up in front. So if somebody would pick up there, we're right near the bottom of page 7, and read through that paragraph.
From the humid air, maybe?
Yeah, sure. A little bit farther down in the paragraph. Say, when the sergeant told them to kill all the Japanese soldiers, do you see where that is?
Yep.
Okay.
When the sergeant told them to kill all the Japanese soldiers lined up in front of the cave with their hands on their heads, Teo could not pull the trigger. The fever made him shiver, and the sweat was stinging his eyes, and he couldn't see clearly. In that instant, he saw Josiah standing there. The face was dark from the sun, and the eyes were squinting, as though he were about to smile at Teo. So Teo stood there, stiff with nausea, while they fired at the soldiers, and he watched his uncle fall, and he knew it was Josiah. And even after Rocky started shaking him by the shoulders and telling him to stop crying, it was still Josiah lying there. They forced medicine into Teo's mouth, and Rocky pushed him toward the corpses and told him to look past the blood that was already dark like the jungle mud, with only flecks of bright red still shimmering in it. Rocky made him look at the corpse and said, "Teo, this is a Jap. This is a Jap uniform." And then he rolled the body over with his boot and said, "Look, Teo, look at the face." And that was when Teo started screaming, because it wasn't a Jap. It was Josiah, eyes shrinking back into the skull and all their shining black light glazed over by death.
And we need to wrap up. Josiah is Teo's uncle. Josiah is the one who brings him medicine when he has a fever. We hear that in the earlier paragraph. Josiah is about the only person who, in a certain sense, mothers, cares for, takes care of Teo. And so when Teo is being told that he has to kill this Japanese soldier, he sees the face of Josiah. And a very simple question. Is Teo right or wrong? Is it the face of Josiah that he is looking at? In his mind it is, and you're just flat out saying yes.
Well, I am my brother's keeper.
That's what you meant by yes. Yeah. See, there's this right there. This is the heart of this tension between different ways of seeing and thinking. Rocky, as his name suggests, has completely inhabited a Western perspective. Rocky wants out of the reservation, wants to join the larger society, and so on. And so Rocky is saying, Teo, you're crazy. This is a Japanese. This is Josiah. Josiah's way back there. Well, literally, we understand that. But for Teo, and the identification is so complete for Teo that we might well say he is feverish or something. But at a fundamental level, right? Teo is right. Teo is right. He's confused in a certain sense, but fundamentally, he's right. Even though we would call it a metaphor, we want to say, well, it's like Josiah's dark skin, and so on and so forth. No. Fundamentally, body of Christ. That metaphor speaks truth. And that's what Teo has touched on. But everything in the culture around him is saying, you're crazy. And so what we're going to watch is how does the healing take place? How does this deep wound get solved? Thank you.